You guys have probably all experienced a time when you just have all kinds of emotions going through you, and like right now I'm scared, I'm nervous, and at the same time I'm excited. You know, I'm sitting here watching all these young people coming in, and I'm thinking, oh Lord. And I don't know, we have been praying, my wife and I have been praying that the Lord would use this time, this weekend, to not only challenge us, but to encourage us, to bless us as a church, and to build us up. And so, as we jump into this morning, that's my prayer, you know, whether you're young or old, that the Lord will use this time, these couple hours that we're going to spend together, to challenge your thinking. And there are going to be some things that are said that make me feel uncomfortable. And so you're probably going to feel uncomfortable as well. And that's just the way it's going to be. This is something that we need to be talking about. And as uncomfortable as we might feel, we're just going to trust the Lord that He'll use it to grow us. When it comes to human sexuality, I am not an expert in any way in this stuff. I am not a trained counselor. I'm not a trained sex therapist. I'm nothing like that. I am a dad, and I'm a grandpa. And I'm an individual who is sexually broken, just like every one of you. Maybe you don't think of yourself like that, but that's the condition that each one of us are in because of our ancestor Adam. None of us here probably would consider ourselves experts in this area of sexuality, but yet every one of us know what it is. At least we participate in it every day. And so maybe this would be a good place to start defining what is human sexuality. What are we talking about? Does the Bible, like, what is biblical sexuality? Does the Bible even talk about that? Well, it does. It just doesn't call it that. Human sexuality is the way people experience and express themselves sexually. This involves biological, psychological, physical, erotic, emotional, social, or spiritual feelings and behaviors. When we say human sexuality is the way you experience and express, people experience and express themselves sexually, if you're like me, you're thinking that that's how we experience sex and express ourselves sexually, thinking of the physical act. And that is a part of human sexuality. That's a part, but it's only a small part. It's much bigger than that. It's basically anything that has to do with gender, male or female, sex. If it has anything to do with any of those things, it's part of human sexuality. You know, as a man, how do I view myself as a man? Like, how do I see myself? How do I view other men? How do I interact with other guys? Whether it's at home or in the workplace, you know, what are the expectations that I have as a man in the bedroom? Those are all aspects of sexuality. As a man, how do I view the female? How do I view the opposite sex? What role do they play in the home or in the workplace, in the bedroom, everywhere? The expectations that we have for each sex or gender in the home, workplace, bedroom, that's all part of human sexuality. The way we view those things, that's what human sexuality is. You know, I might view things very different than you, and you might view them very different from the guy sitting next to you. But we as a culture, there are cultural norms that we kind of hold to. You know, like, we would view things differently, thinking of human sexuality, we would view things differently than a Muslim culture would. Or maybe an Oriental culture, an Asian culture. You know, we view things differently. We're witnessing our culture around us changing on a daily basis. This aspect of human sexuality, we're constantly being pushed in different directions, how we view these things, how we interact with each other. Some people think that that's a good thing. Some people think that it's bad. It's important that as we think about human sexuality, for the most part, that we need to realize that we basically learn that from our environment. It's important that we understand that as we try to understand each other. Because our understanding of human sexuality is, to a large part, generational. You know, some of you guys are probably my age. You know, you're in your 60s. When I was raised as a boy, when I was younger, men were men and women were women. You never heard about anybody being confused about their gender. The men knew their roles and the women knew their place. That's how I was raised. And that was normal. But nowadays, that view is considered toxic masculinity. That's what it's called. And today's kids, they're just like I was. They're learning their views of sexuality. Their views are being shaped by the culture around them, by the things that they see every day. They're just like you and I. Gender roles today aren't as clearly defined. That's shaping their view on human sexuality. You know, for little ones, gender roles are largely learned at home. Family, for most of them, consists of mom, dad, siblings. Maybe mom works. Maybe she doesn't. That's not the way it used to be. You know, for the most part, mom stayed home with the kids and dad worked. Well, nowadays, mom works, mom doesn't work. Dad works, maybe dad stays home. You know, all those things are just shaping their views. Watching mom and dad interact with each other helps to shape their view of sexuality, whether positive or negative. You know, some of your kids, their friends, have parents who are divorced. That's normal for them. Single parent families, very normal. Blended families, very normal. You know, as they watch cartoons, they're seeing things that seem normal to them. See, I grew up with Popeye and olive oil. Well, today they're growing up with like Princess Bee and her two dads. They're growing up and thinking that is normal. I have a list here in my notes of at least a dozen or more cartoons that are LGBTQ friendly. And there, one or more of these cartoons is shown on every one of the streaming platforms. If you have Hulu, Nickelodeon, Netflix, the Cartoon Network, Disney Plus, PBS Kids, if you have Prime, all of these streaming platforms have one or more of these cartoons. And so kids are being exposed to that, and they're seeing that not as you might see it. You might look at it and say, oh, that's bad. They look at it and it's normal. That's what they see all the time. It's normal for them. Their view of sexuality is being formed. And we might want to think that our kids are being taught truth at home and at church. But think about it. How often do you talk about these kind of things with your kids? How often do they hear about these kinds of things at church? If we think about it and we're honest, it's probably only maybe a handful of times a year that subjects like this would come up. And so we think that we're influencing our kids, where every day, especially if they're going to public school or they're watching cartoons, every day they're being taught something different. Again, their view of sexuality is being changed. And it's happening all the time. You know, they probably are learning from mom and dad, from church, you know, God's view is one man, one woman, covenant, relationship, marriage, all of that. And they can agree with that. They can believe that to be true because mom and dad said it was true. And so they just believe it's true. And then at the same time, they'll go to school and they probably have some kids that are either gay or lesbian, or they have siblings that are, you know, and so that's influencing them. And kids don't, especially young kids, they don't often have the ability to look at these two things that kind of seem contrary and be able to distinguish. They just see both of them as normal. That's how you grew up. We don't think about it. We don't realize that that's what's happened. But that's how your view of sexuality was shaped. And it's no different for them. It's just the world you grew up in, or I grew up in, is vastly different than the world they're growing up in. We just have to be aware of that. What first got me thinking about all of this, you know, a couple years back was my oldest daughter, Jessica. You know, a number of years ago, she found herself as a single mom with four kids. And her oldest son, her oldest kid, a boy, was becoming a teenager. And Jessica was wanting to be a good mom, and she's wanting to try and prepare her kids as best as she could. And so she started reading books on how to address some of these things. And she came across this book, Rethinking Sexuality, God's Design and Why It Matters by Julie Slattery. I don't know, is that on the table back there, Julie? It's a really good book. Well, anyway, she gives me this book, and she says, Dad, I want you to read this. Because at that point, I was the dad in her son's, her oldest son's life. I was the male influence there. And she's like, Dad, I want you to read this. And right away in the first chapter of that book, the author starts asking this question. She says, someone is discipling your child in the area of sexuality. If it's not you, then who's doing that? And that really got my attention. And every one of you sitting in here, especially you parents, you need to consider that. Your child is being discipled in the area of human sexuality. If you're not the one doing it, who is? Who's the one that's teaching your kid how to think about gender, gender identity, sex, sexual preference, sexual orientation, and on goes the list? If it's not you doing that, somebody else is. Who is? That's an important question. Anyway, this morning I just want to, before we get going any farther, I just want to explain, you know, briefly state what our goals are for this weekend. The first thing is that our goal is to start dialogues. And that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of excited when I look out there and I see all you young people. The last thing I know you want to do is talk to your mom or dad about sex. And I can guarantee you the last thing your mom or dad want to do is talk to you about sex. But what I just said about being discipled, you are being discipled. You're being trained in how to think about these things. And I'll tell you, the kids at school, they know less than you do. And if they're the ones helping you figure this out, you're going to grow up screwed up. I can tell you right now, the best source that you have, the best source of information that God has given you to help you not just have a, you know, somebody to talk to, but to grow up and have a successful, blessed life, to have the most successful chance at a good marriage, the people that God has, the one who God has given you is your parents. And so as uncomfortable it is if mom or dad say, hey, we need to talk, don't fight that. Don't resist that. So one of our goals is to help start dialogues. And this is a gift for you parents, because now you don't have to think about, oh, how can I talk about that? I'm going to give you the opportunity today, because on the way home, you can say, man, did you hear what Tim said about whatever it is? What'd you think of that? I think he was messed up when he said this. What do you think? And you can have a dialogue and you can start it. Anyway, that's our first goal. The second goal is to explain our position. Now, I kind of choked when Pastor Tim was up here and he says, we're going to talk about all these things. We're not. We don't have enough time. We could spend an hour on each one of these little things and still not scratch the surface. We've got 3 hours today and 1 hour tomorrow, so we're going to pick a few that we think are more pertinent to us, and the rest of them are just going to maybe be mentioned, And even many of them aren't even going to get mentioned this morning. And so, in the things that we talk about, we want to state our position. What, not our position, but hopefully what is the Bible's position on these things. And then at the same time, we want to talk about our posture. And what I mean by posture is this, position and posture. The Lord displays, you know, demonstrates this for us in a number of times in the Scriptures. In John chapter 8, for example, you have the woman who's caught in adultery. You know, the Lord's position on her lifestyle, how the Lord viewed her lifestyle, was very clear. He was not in faith. He did not agree with the choices that she made, with the life choices, that, you know, the direction that she was going. It was very clear. His position was that it was sin, and he encourages her to leave that life of sin. All the while, his position was one of grace, one of love, compassion, mercy. His position was truth. His posture was love. And it was only after displaying his posture, only after displaying grace and love and compassion, that he addressed the issue of truth. It's so important. If you come at somebody with truth, you are just basically pushing them away. You've all probably heard, if they don't know that you care, I don't even know how that quote goes, they need to know that you care before they need to hear the truth or something like that. True. If they don't know that you love them, they don't care what you have to say as far as truth. You have to establish grace first. You have to come at them with grace, compassion, be their friend, show love to them, to give you the opportunity to share truth. As you read through the Gospels, look at how the Lord interacts with people, and you'll see that every time. The only time the Lord is harsh and critical is when he's talking to the religious people who are looking down their nose at everybody else. And I hope that we would, if we're honest enough with ourselves, that we can see that we are often that. The Lord would be yelling at us, not them. Because we often do that. We often look down our nose at them. We are the holy, the righteous, the pure, they're the sinners. Well, as soon as they sense that from you, you will never have the opportunity to impact their life with truth because you've pushed them away. And so we just need to consider that. We're just going to talk about that. Again, we're just touching surfaces here, and so that's where we're going. Ephesians 4:15 talks about speaking truth in love, and that's what Christ modeled in his interactions with the lady caught in adultery. The woman at the well is another example. We're going to try to walk that tightrope. We're going to try to walk that line. That line that, you know, our desire is to hate what Jesus hated and to love what Jesus loves. That's our goal this morning. And so as we go through this conference, I hope it becomes obvious. I hope it becomes so clear that in order to do this, in order to speak truth and love, we need to walk in dependence upon God's Spirit. The only way we're going to see this happening is if we are walking in submission to the Lord and His Spirit as He seeks to guide us. That's the only way it's going to happen. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump into this. And while we do, I got to crack open a bottle because I'm already getting dry mouth. So this is your time to take a drink. Here we go. Oh, that's excellent water. Romans chapter 1, Paul lays out kind of the digression of the human race. And that's going to be loosely our outline as we kind of work through this. We're going to follow Paul's progression, because Paul does lay out a flow. One thing does lead to another. So this morning, that's what we're going to follow. So we're going to start out in Romans 1:19. And again, it's not a verse-by-verse study. This is just our outline. In Romans 1:19, he says, "What can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And so this first hour, we're going to be focusing on what may be known about God through his creation, specifically human sexuality and the God and God's divine nature. And then Paul goes on and he says in verse 21, "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God, and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images." They knew God, but they didn't want God. They had an intense desire for something else. That's the definition of lust. And so we're going to talk about lust. But he goes on and he says, "Therefore God gave them up in the lust of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies amongst themselves." So God allows them to pursue their lust and the dishonoring of their bodies. And that's talking about heterosexual issues. The dishonoring of their bodies here, that's heterosexual. Okay, so we're going to talk about that in the second hour. And then Paul goes on in verse 25, 26, he says, "They exchanged the truth about God for a lie. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For the woman exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men, likewise, gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passions for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error." That's talking about homosexuality. We're going to touch on that in the third hour. But then Paul also goes on and he says in verse 28, "So God gave them up to a debased mind to do things that ought not be done." So during the third hour, we're also going to be talking about mentioning some of the things that ought not to be done. The progression, Paul gets to a point where he stops. He doesn't continue to name the things because there is no end to what the depraved human mind can come up with. And so he just says things that ought not be done. We'll touch on that. And then tomorrow, we're going to try and answer a question. Again, we're going to touch on the question, so how shall we live? As followers of Christ, how should you and I be living in this sex-saturated, this culture that we live in? And so that's where we're going. Okay, so for the rest of this first hour, let's consider what may be known about God. Back in Romans 1:19, God has shown it to us. And we're talking specifically about his divine nature. Paul says that through his divine nature, or his divine nature was made plain to us through the creation. He says, I'm too quick. He says, "For what may be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them." You know, I would argue that as we look at this topic of God's design and intent for human sexuality, we're going to see a lot about God's divine nature. You know, here in Romans, Paul kind of gives us big picture. Like, there is no detail in that. He just says, you can see it through creation, and he moves right on. But Moses, on the other hand, talks about the exact same thing, although he doesn't call it God's divine nature. He calls it God's image. And so Moses gives us a lot of information about that. And so let's go back to Genesis chapter 2. And because of time, and hopefully the fact that we're all pretty familiar with Genesis 1 and 2, let's just summarize real quick. Because there's a lot of things that we see about human sexuality in these verses. And we'll summarize some of the most obvious things we see regarding human sexuality. And then we'll try and tie them all together, okay? I think we all realize that human sexuality was God's idea, and gender was God's idea. In Genesis 1:27, in the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Here it's pretty clear how things started. Genesis, there's only two genders. Now our culture's in the process of redefining those terms, and so I think it's important for us to right here just to nail down those definitions. The male, that is the man, this is an individual who had a penis and he had XY chromosomes. Those are the two things that make him male. And for lack of time, you know, I kind of want to jump off on that because even in reality, only one of those things makes him a male, and that's his XY chromosomes. And our culture's kind of telling us the other size, you know, size matter, all that kind of crap that we hear. That's defining what it is to be a man? No. The fact that I have XY chromosomes is what makes me a man. Okay, female, that's a woman. Again, today our culture is refusing to define what a woman is. Well, a woman is an individual, she has a vagina, and she has XX chromosomes. And you're probably sitting there thinking, why have you even got to say that? And I'm up here thinking, I wish I didn't have to say that. Because it's weird. It's odd. It's uncomfortable. But our culture is pushing us into this position, into this place where you have to say those kind of things to actually define what we're talking about. Now, a lot of people would actually say that I'm reading into the text to say those things because nowhere in Genesis 1 or 2 does it talk about their genitalia or their chromosomes. And that's true. It doesn't say that. So am I reading into it? Am I reading those definitions into those words? No, I'm not. And it's important for us to understand how we're supposed to be reading our Bibles. You know, when Moses wrote Genesis, he wrote those verses to an oral culture. They relied on oral history. They didn't have written. Most of the people, when Moses wrote the book of Genesis, very few people could read it. It was an oral culture. They got their definitions, they got their understanding from the story. Okay, that's important for us to remember because we're a written culture. We like our words to be specific and defined. Okay, I want to know what a man is. I go to the dictionary and it tells me. In an oral culture, they don't have that. They have stories that define things. And so as you go through the stories, you pick up the definitions. And so can I say for a fact that Adam had a penis and was XY chromosomes and Eve had a vagina and was XX chromosome? Can I say that? I can. And how can I? If I get it from the story. How do I know that? It's because in the story, it says that they had kids. And it's impossible. That's the only possible combination for a couple to produce children. Okay, one of them has to have XY chromosomes and the other has to have XX chromosomes. Two individuals who have XX chromosomes, it doesn't matter how they identify, they will never produce children. It doesn't matter what hormones they're taking or anything, they will never produce children. And two individuals who have XY chromosomes, regardless of how they identify, they will never produce children. Okay, so as the story goes, he tells us they had kids. So we know that what I just said about their genitalia and their chromosomes, we know that is true. That is factual. It's the only possible combination. You know, another area that we read about is marriage. And again, today marriage is considered a cultural construct. It's something that our culture is forcing on us. You know, it's a byproduct of religion, and that is not true. That's one of the benefits that I see of being part of Ethnos 360 or New Tribes. You know, New Tribes is all over the globe working with isolated people groups that have never had, prior to the missionaries getting in, many of them never had contact with any outside religion. And yet they all practice marriage. We have not found one culture on the planet that does not practice marriage. And that's because marriage was God's idea from the very beginning. And so every culture that came from Adam and Eve, they practice marriage. And so that's God's idea. Now, some of you might be thinking, it is important to realize that in Genesis 1 and 2, nowhere does it actually say that they were married. You know, that they actually had a ceremony. But some of you are probably thinking, whoa, what about Genesis 2:25 where it says Adam and his wife? I am going to run out of time, I can tell you right now. I'm going to Adam and his wife. You know, when we read wife, that's a translation issue. The word for wife is the word isha. And that word is used 780 times in the Old Testament, and over 41% of the time it's translated woman, not wife. And so when whoever translated this verse, they had the option of using the word wife or woman. Is this where maybe his religious bias bled into the translation, and that's why he said Adam and his wife? Again, the story gives us the definition. The story tells us how that word should be translated. Because we find out, this takes us into the next area, and that's sex and family. We find out that God tells them, Adam and Eve, to be fruitful and multiply. Now, fruitful is code for have sex. Okay, God's telling them, go have sex and produce children. And we know from the story what? The only time God tells a couple to have sex is when they're married. Okay, I'm not reading into it to say Adam and his wife. We get that from the story. In fact, the only time that God tells a man and a woman to be fruitful is in marriage. If a man and a woman hook up outside of marriage, the scripture is very clear that that's considered sin. And so, hey, we have a man and a woman here together. There's no shame. There's no guilt. We'll get into more of this in just a bit. But, you know, we have one man, one woman, a married couple, and they're told to enjoy each other and to raise a family in the process. Everything from emotional intimacy to the very physical act of sexual intercourse, all of that was God's idea. God made gender, marriage, sex. It was all beautiful and good and wholesome. And it's important to remember that it was in that context, in the context of that relationship, that God said, raise a family. In that context, God said, have kids, multiply, and raise your kids in that environment. Again, marriage is part of God's blessing on mankind. Sex is a part of God's blessing on mankind. The family is part of God's blessing on mankind. So in a nutshell, God made sex and sexuality, and what did he say? He said it was very good. Those are all the normal things, the obvious things that we talk about. So let's think about God's divine nature and how it's manifested through his creation, particularly human sexuality. Let's just think about this a little more specifically. In Genesis 1:26, God said, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." And then he goes on and he says, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and blah, blah, blah. You know, in a way, it kind of sounds like God said, let's make them in our image so that we can delegate some of the load to them, some of the work. It's almost like God's plate was too full and he's got to get rid of some stuff. And so let's make man so he can do some of this stuff. And that's really not what's going on at all. His workload wasn't too heavy and he didn't need it lightened up at all. Apparently, ruling and having dominion over something is actually part of the blessing. You know, he says in Revelation 5:10, he says that, and you have made a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. Apparently, ruling over the animal kingdom is directly connected to us bearing his likeness. Work, authority, responsibility, they're all part of God's nature, and he made us with those for those things as well. I find myself trying to avoid those very things. I don't want to go through all eternity having to rule and reign over something. That's because I have a warped sense of what that means. I don't know what that looks like in a perfect environment. Anyway, he goes on, says he created man in his own image, male and female created he them. Again, male and female is directly connected to us bearing his image. Those two things are in the same image, or the same sentence, the same breath. Male and female, God's image, same thing. So let's think about that for a second. In the first two chapters of Genesis, Moses gives us the whole creation account. In Genesis 1, it's a summary of the week. And then in Genesis chapter 2, he backs up and he kind of focuses in on the creation of mankind, on the creation of the human. And he says in Genesis 2:7, the Lord God formed Adam out of the dust of the ground. And he says in verse 19, out of the dust, out of the ground, the Lord God had formed every beast. And so man and animal are the same in that sense. We're both formed from the dirt, from the dust of the ground. And yet with Adam, it says that he took Adam and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living creature. Some of your translations say a living soul. Again, that word for soul or being is found 753 times, and 475 times it's translated soul. The Brown's Driver Briggs Lexicon defines that word as soul, living being, life, self, person, desire, appetite, emotion, passion. All of those things are part of what it means to be a living soul. Desire, appetite, emotion, passion. We can definitely see those in humanity. And God gave those to us, gave them to Adam to possess, because those are traits that he possesses. Let's think about that a second. Is there a reason that God gave those characteristics to man and not the rest of the animal kingdom? Why did God not do that with all the animals? Some of you might be thinking, well, my cat has those characteristics. My dog has those characteristics. And that might be true. Maybe it is. But they don't even come close to comparing to your best friend, you know, to another person. They can't compare on the level that a human does. So why are humans so vastly different from the animal kingdom? One reason I think God's wanting to communicate is that, you know, the more relational intimacy that you have is dependent on what you have in common. By relation, I was thinking about this last night. What, you know, maybe that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Relational intimacy. What am I talking about when I say that? You know, we all have people. We all have friends. Like, you know, maybe somebody comes up to you and says, you know, Sunday morning you're in church, and somebody that you know, they come up and say, hey, how's school this week? And you say, good. And that's it. Somebody says, hey, how was work? It was good, you know. The next person comes up, you know them a little more, the depth of relational intimacy is a little deeper, and they come up and say, hey, how was school this past week? And then, oh man, it's getting hard. I can't wait till summer. You know, you give them a little more information because the depth of relationship is deeper. And then there's some, we all have somebody to where, you know, if they say, hey man, how was school or how was work? And it's like, oh man, it sucks. You know, it's like, and we go into detail with how it was because our depth of relationship is deeper. Because we, for whatever reason, we have more in common with them. There's more relationship. That's what we're talking about with relational intimacy here. God's desire for us to have relationship with him is different than his desire to have relationship with the rest of his creation. God has a relationship with all of his creation, but his relationship with us is deeper because we have more in common with him. We are created in his image. All the traits that we just mentioned, he has those, we have those, we have that in common, and his desire is for us to have deep relational intimacy. That's God's desire. That's why we're different. To illustrate that a little bit. So you have a goldfish and you have a dog. Which one do you relate to more? It's the dog. There's no doubt about it. The goldfish does not give a flip when you come home from work or when you walk in the door, but that dog does. That dog is connected to you. Relationally, there's more interaction. Well, it's the same with us. Relational depth is different. You know, another thing that God, I believe, is modeling through this whole thing of giving us, you know, breathing into us, mankind, the breath of life. He's modeling that there are different levels of relationship. Again, he has a relationship with all of creation, but it's only with man, it's only with us that he enters into a covenant relationship. And again, I could have a relationship with every one of you, and some of you I know, most of you I have no clue who you are. But there's a little bit of relationship there. It's different. The relationship I have with Julie is different than the relationship I have with the rest of you, deeper. The relationship I have with my wife, multiple times different, deeper. And God's modeling that even through his creation. He desires a deeper level of relationship with us. It's all that. Let's think about this. The Trinity, the Godhead. God is triune, three in one. Three in person, one in essence. I'm not going to spend hardly any time talking about this because we can't even begin to wrap our brain about what that really means. But it is important for us to think about. God is three distinct individuals, Father, Son, Spirit, each one in and of himself, totally God. And that symbol up there often is used to represent the Trinity. To help us understand a little bit more about the Trinity, I want to just take a second and consider what the Trinity is not. The Trinity is not modalism. Modalism says that there's one God manifested in three forms, not three distinct persons. And probably some of you, you're trying to tell, you know, teach a little kid about what God's like, and we'll use the example of, well, God's like water. You know, you can find water in liquid, solid, and in gas forms. Okay, well, that's modalism. That's water is water in three different forms. It's kind of like me saying, you know, God is kind of like me. You know, I'm one person, and yet I'm a father, I'm a husband, and I'm a maintenance man. Okay, well, that's not what the Trinity's like. They're not three person, it's not one person manifested in three ways. Three distinct persons. Three in person, one in essence. It's not Arianism. Arianism says Christ and the Spirit are creations of the Father. Again, we might say, you know, the Trinity is kind of like the sun, where you have the star and you have heat and light. Well, that's a really bad example. That's a really bad illustration because the star creates the heat and the light. You don't have heat and think, I got a star. Does that make sense? You know, Arianism, the Jehovah's Witness believe a form of Arianism. They believe that Jehovah God created Jesus, and then Jesus created everything else. That's Arianism. That is not what the Trinity's like. It's also not partialism. Partialism says the Father, Son, and Spirit are not distinct persons. They're just one-third. They're not distinct individuals in the Godhead. They're one-third of the Godhead. And again, we'll say God is kind of like the egg. You've got the shell, you've got the white and the yolk. That's what God's like. No, it's not at all what God's like. Like the three-leaf clover. You take one of them away, you no longer have a three-leaf clover, right? You know, God isn't a third. The Father isn't a third of God. He is God. Jesus isn't a third of God. He is God. The Holy Spirit isn't a third of God. He is God. And so you've got the three persons of the Godhead, the three persons of the Trinity, three individual persons. For all of eternity, those three individuals have interacted and had a relationship that was pure, and there was just nothing there. Talking about relational depth, there's no limits to that. And God is also modeling that for us in human sexuality. That's his desire for us, relationship. Okay, considering that Adam, or God gave, you know, these different characteristics, life, self-awareness, personhood, desire, appetite, emotion, passion, all those things. We have all of that in common with God. Adam had all of that in common with the Lord, and yet the Lord said, it's not good that man should be alone. Was Adam alone? He had God. He had all the animals. He wasn't alone. And yet he was. He was alone. Again, the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Spirit, total, complete relational intimacy because they were one in essence. And God's wanting Adam and Eve to know that relational intimacy on the same level. But although we're similar to God, there are many areas where we are not the same as God. We are not in one essence with God. Adam, in that sense, was alone. No, there was no one that he could share total, complete relational intimacy with. And so God's going to do something about that. God says, it's not good that he's going to be alone, so I'm going to make a helper for him. But it almost seems like God said that, and then all of a sudden he got distracted. Like, oh, I forgot to name the animals. And so he tells Adam. He says, it says in verse 19, out of the ground the Lord God had formed every beast of the animal, and he brought them to the man to see what the man would call them, and whatever the man called them, every living creature, that was his name. The man gave animals to all the livestock, to the birds of heaven, and to the beasts of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. This, I believe, is where the physical aspect of our personhood comes into the picture. Adam, by this point, realized that he had a body, that he was physical. Everything around him is physical. And we don't really know how God was manifesting himself to Adam. You know, there are theories about that. But we don't really know, you know, how God and Adam interacted. We know they did. But there's probably very little doubt that Adam was confused about the fact that he was man, he was physical, and God was God. They were similar in many ways, and yet they were worlds apart. And so as Adam's naming all these animals, thinking about the physical aspect of the creation and all this, he's seeing each species has a mate. And remember what God told the animals to do? Same thing he told Adam and Eve. To be fruitful and multiply. He told the animals to do that. And so you can bet that as Adam's walking around the garden or he's sitting there, however it worked out to where he's naming the animals, you can bet that he's watching and some of those animals are mating. And he's seeing that. It's like, whoa, what's happening over there? He sees that there's a male, female, and he's seeing that they're compatible. They come together, you know, in a way that he is now all of a sudden aware of there's nobody for him. He's similar to God, but not. He's similar to the animals in a way, the physical aspect, but he's different from them. There is nobody like him. He goes on and says, there was found for him no helper fit for him. The word for helper is the word neged. And it means one that corresponds to. Strong defines the word as a front, a part opposite, kind of a specifically a counterpart. And so you've got Adam here, thinking of a jigsaw puzzle. You've got Adam, one piece of the puzzle, and there's nothing that's counter. There's no counterpart for him. He's seeing all the animals. They all have part and counterpart. They all, male and female, they all have somebody who is like them in essence, and yet the counterpart. And Adam has nothing like that. This whole exercise of naming the animals was in order to show Adam his need. Verse 22 says, so the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. And while he slept, he took one of his ribs and closed its place up with flesh. And the rib that he that the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to him. So Adam provides that which Eve's made from. Eve's not made from the dirt, she's made from Adam. And so they are one in essence. They are made from the very same stuff. And you can almost picture this. God bringing the woman to the man. You can almost picture, in my mind, I'm picturing God bringing the woman, walking her down the path, walking her down the aisle. And somebody saying, who gives this woman to this man? And God saying, I do. To me, that's just a cool picture as I think about that. So now we've got Adam and we've got Eve. We've got these two pieces that complement each other, physically the same, or shall I say, in essence, they're the same, and yet they're different. And we know that Adam was looking for her. As he was naming the animals, he's looking for her. And finally, he finds her, and he says, at last, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Finally, she's here. Up to now, Adam has been called Ish. The word that is translated man is Ish. And the word Ishah, you can hear the difference. The word Ishah is the female version of Ish, or better yet, the counterpart of Ish. Ishah was taken out of Ish. Man or woman was taken out of man. Female was taken out of male. It's cool how even in the English language we project the very same thing that's being taught here in Genesis. The woman was taken out of the man. And so physically they're the same. And they have that in common, yet they're part and counterpart. And I was reading one author, and I forgot, I didn't take the time to write his name down, and I should have. There was one author that was making the point that their bodies reflect their souls. And what he meant by that was that how they're made spoke to their intended roles. Adam, the man, the one who provided, it was the rib taken from him. He gave the rib. He gave that which she was made from. He was the provider. He gave of himself for his wife. And the fact that he was made first and the provider means that he was to be the leader and the protector. He was the giver. And that's reflected in his physical body. Think of that sexually. He's the one that gives. Eve, the woman, she's the helper. She's the one who's to follow his lead. She's the one that receives protection and provision from Adam. And again, that's reflected in her body as well. Sexually, she's the one that receives him. It's just kind of a cool picture, thinking about how God did all of that. It goes on in verse 25. It says, the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed. And traditionally, or for the most part, we basically think of that as like they're standing in the garden butt naked. But it is so much more than that. They are without clothes. That's part of it. But what it's talking about is their relationship. There was nothing. There were no secrets. There were no insecurities. There were no feelings of inadequacy. There were no feelings of jealousy, animosity, resentment. There was no hidden agenda. There was no manipulation. There was no trying to work things to get their way. There was no guilt. There was no secrets. That's the intimacy that's reflected in that statement. They were naked and unashamed. And that's reflected in the relationship shared within the Godhead. They were fully known and fully loved. I believe God has instilled the desire for that type of intimate relationship in every one of us. We're born with a desire for that type of relationship. Here's a quote from Timothy Keller, and I think it's a good one. He says, to be loved but not known is comforting, but it's superficial. In other words, you have somebody come up to you and they say, love ya, but they don't know the first thing about you. It might feel good to have somebody say, I love you, but you know it's surface. And most of us are comfortable with that kind of a relationship because we believe the second part of his statement, which is to be known and not loved is our greatest fear. You and I, every one of us, believe that to be true. That's why we all live with secrets. Every one of us live with secrets. And I know I say that. I've said that a couple times at our church, and I have people look like, oh, there are no secrets between me and my wife. Yeah, there are. If I ran home and told my wife every time I had an inappropriate thought about another woman, she would be freaked out. It would impact our relationship. Now, if my wife said, hey, did you have any inappropriate thoughts today? I would tell her. It's not that I'm lying to her, but I don't volunteer every thought because I know it would impact our relationship. And every one of you are the same way. There are things you don't tell. Not that you wouldn't if you were asked, but you don't volunteer that information because you're convinced that if they knew you, really knew you, well, they might not like you. They might not love you. And that is a fear that we all have. Well, Keller goes on and he says, but to be fully known and truly loved, well, that's a lot like being loved by God. That's just so cool. That's how the members of the Godhead are. They know each other fully and intimately. In eternity past, they've had that type of relationship. Fully known, fully loved. That's how God sees you. You are fully known. He knows every thought that you have ever had in the deepest, darkest recesses of your mind. He knows that. And I don't know about you, but when I think about that, that scares the snot out of me until I stop and realize that even though God knows my every thought, he loves me completely. I am fully known by God. Sorry. And I am fully loved. And I believe that God has instilled the desire for that type of relationship, that type of deep, intimate relationship in every one of us. That level of relational intimacy is what we were created for. I got to hurry up. The sex drive, let me just jump to that. The sex drive. You know, universally, the sex drive is considered to be the second strongest drive that the human being has. Second only to the will to survive, the drive for survival. And I would agree with that. I've heard it said that a man thinks of sex every 7 seconds. And in my experience, I agree with that. Why is the sex drive so strong? I believe that it's really a drive for relational intimacy. I would argue that it's not a drive for sex, but it's rather a drive for intimacy, relational intimacy, that God has given each one of us. It's because of our sin nature, though. It's because of being born broken, sexually broken, that drive for relational intimacy is twisted and warped. And for many, that drive is not for relational intimacy, but physical intimacy. We call it the sex drive. For others, it might be the drive for emotional intimacy. You know, in other words, another way to phrase that could be, for some, it would be a Playboy magazine or online porn. For others, it might be a Harlequin romance, if you know what those are, or like 50 Shades of Grey, you know, where you're just getting into the emotional aspect of things. Both of those, the physical and the emotional, are part of the intimacy that God desires for us to enjoy. You know, not long ago, I had a guy ask me, we were talking about all this, he's like, man, why is the sex drive so crazy? Why is it something I struggle with so much? Well, C.S. Lewis has another quote. It's a good one. C.S. Lewis says, our desires are not too strong, they're too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling around with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us. Like the ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what it is like to be off by the offer of a holiday by the sea. we are far too easily pleased. And by pursuing after one aspect of the relational intimacy that God intends, by just pursuing one of those, we are selling ourselves short. As men, if we are hard pursuing the drive for sex, we are cutting ourselves short. If our drive is only for the emotional, that's what Lewis is saying. We're settling for something so much less than what God intended. You know, in my marriage, I can see both of these tendencies displayed, especially when we were younger. When we were younger and we just newly married, the physical aspect, you know, the sex side of our relationship, that was my focus. Carrie's was the emotional side. When it was time to go to bed, my brain, I'm thinking sex. Carrie's thoughts, you know what she was thinking about? Just being together, just snuggling. And it's like for some, you know, a lot of marriages, this is where there's a lot of friction. Because for some, just snuggling is not even an option. I can't do that, to just snuggle. It automatically, and it's like there's just friction like that. God's design is for both of us to enjoy both of those things. That's one of the things that I've enjoyed about growing old with her, is the older we get. You know, when we were first married, I was sure that the love that I had for her, it could not grow anymore. I just loved her that much. But now that I look back 40 years later, the love that I thought I had for her pales in comparison to the love that I have for her now. And we are closer now to enjoying that depth of relational intimacy than we've ever been, and yet we are miles away from what God intended. We just have so much more room to grow. Got to keep moving. Another aspect of relational intimacy that God intended to reflect of the Godhead, you know, in 1 John 4, we learn that God is love. And as the Godhead shares this relational intimacy, this pure love and joy that they had with each other, out of that love, God created us. Not out of need. He didn't need to, you know, us. The Godhead created us because they wanted to. And that's reflected in human sexuality as well. You know, we can all have a level of relationship with everyone. But with that one individual, that one who is of the same essence, that one who is part and counterpart, God's design was for that one man and that one woman to enter into a covenant relationship of marriage. And in that relationship, to enjoy pure, deep relational intimacy, to be fully known and fully loved, to express that in their physical bodies, each one giving 100% of themselves for the other, for the betterment of the other, and for the pleasure of the other. And in the process of enjoying that relationship, life would be created. That's a reflection of the Godhead, how he set that all up. That's just cool. And it wasn't that that life was to be created in that. It was that life was also to be nurtured in that type of relationship. It's a beautiful picture. And so as we wrap up this first session, it's probably a good time to stop and define what we mean by marriage. And so let's just do that. Marriage. Marriage is one man. We believe that this is what the Bible teaches, that marriage is one man, one woman, and a lifelong, consensual, loving, covenant marriage relationship, where each one is giving 100% of themselves for the betterment of the other. Marriage isn't a 50-50. It's a 100-100. And it's God's design that in that type of relationship that life is created and nurtured. That's what we would think of as the biblical concept of marriage. And so in the next hour, we're going to see how what God intended to communicate about himself. And we're going to see that in how man has taken and perverted that. And the definition of perversion, what we mean by that is the alteration of something from its original course, from its original meaning or state, to a distortion or a corruption of what was first intended. And so next hour, we're going to talk about lust and heterosexual issues. We're going to talk about what God intended in his design of human sexuality, how what God intended was taken and corrupted, altered, perverted, and some of the issues that come out of that. And so let's just pray real quick, and then we'll take a break. Lord, thank you again for your love. It's just so cool to stop and think about how you created us and what you were trying to communicate about yourself in that creation. Lord, you're an awesome God. What a privilege it is to know you and to be able to walk with you and to have a relationship with you. Thank you for the way you made us. Thank you for the relationships that we have with one another. Lord, I thank you for my bride. I thank you for giving her to me. I thank you for the way that you have blessed us. And as I look at that relationship, Lord, I can see my relationship with you being modeled. And I'm thankful for that. Ask your blessings on our time. Thank you for this opportunity to have a little break, and just pray that you would bless our time together in Christ's name. Amen.